Hi, I'm Sadie Katz. You would know me possibly from Wrong Turn 6 or Space Wars. And you are listening to the Don't Go Out There horror podcast.
In a world where zombies, ghosts, serial killers, and vampires all exist, it's Nico, Brian, Mike, and Dustin. And they are all that stand between you and the films that could end the world. Welcome to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Don't Go Out There Horror Movie Podcast. Just want to thank all our fans and listeners. We really appreciate the support. You guys are awesome. I'm super excited for this upcoming interview. We are honored to be joined today by someone who has quickly made a name for herself in the genre, a writer, actress, documentarian, and producer, known for Wrong Turn 6, The Bill Murray Project, and the recent Space Wars, Miss Sadie Katz. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I'm stoked.
Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it. Miss Sadie, can you talk to us about how you got started in the business? Is acting something you've always had a desire to do?
Well, yeah, I think I was like, you know, I'm going to date myself, but in the 80s, pretty much like everyone did talent shows and lip syncing and, you know, where I lived didn't really have a lot of theater, but I did that. And I was like one of those people, which is kind of a gift now, I realize, like at 4 years old, where I was like, I'm going to be an actress. It's what I want to be, which has been kind of cool because, you know, I can be indecisive, but acting's always been like the thing that sort of helps me make my decisions. For better or for worse.
Right. Well, we brought this up, and I want to jump right into it because I'm excited to ask you about this. I mean, I saw you were a producer for the Bill Murray Experience. I mean, it doesn't get much bigger than Murray. I'm a huge Bill Murray fan, huge Ghostbusters fan. What was that experience like? Pun intended there.
I know. Well, the whole idea sort of came from the fact that I was also like a huge Bill Murray fan. But do you remember at the time he was doing all these like he kind of got into pop culture of being more than just an actor. He was like giving random experiences to people. Mm-hmm. Everyone had like a Bill Murray story. He almost was becoming like a, you know, the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. It, all of a sudden, everyone was talking about, you know, Bill showing up and playing their saxophone or taking them on a crazy, you know, ride to a cab to a bar and serving the bar. So right. I started to get like, every time I'd hear a story, I'd be like, I'm like Bill Murray. I want to go hang out with Bill Murray. Like, I want that kind of crazy experience. And I'll tell you, it actually was like sort of a stoner thought of like, how can I meet Bill Murray and hang with Bill Murray? And I don't know, like, I'm sure you guys know anybody who does any kind of art or podcast or story, like what starts as something kind of fun oftentimes becomes a lot of work and, and also a bit of an obsession. Because that's the nature of the beast. So it was like with my girlfriends, we were like, you know, let's do this. Let's go on this Bill Murray quest. Because the big thing was, and now it's different actually. But, you know, when I did it 5 years ago, Bill didn't have a cell phone. He didn't have a phone number. He didn't really have like an official contact. So there was something really kind of fun about having that project and getting to see what it would take to track down Bill Murray. And then in the meantime, I ended up meeting his brother, Joel, and PJ Souls, and they kind of became part of the story. And, you know, as what happens with most projects, my girlfriends and I kind of broke up and they didn't want to look for Bill Murray. I was too obsessed with Bill Murray. And, it's funny because it seems like, so at the same time that I was doing that project, I ended up getting cast in Wrong Turn. So I'm sort of doing this documentary about being like a, you know, quote unquote, super fan. And then all of a sudden I get in this wildly crazy popular horror franchise, for better or for worse. Like, right. People love it or hate it, but they tend to have a real opinion if you're a horror fan. And so I started to get a lot of fan mail, and I kind of experienced, like, there's something very creepy about that. So, but I was already kind of knee deep in the Bill Murray project, Bill Murray experience, but that my project. So it was a very weird thing. Let's say it was complex.
I understand.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome, though. I mean,
yeah,
hanging out with Bill Murray in any capacity, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, the three of us would love to hang out with Bill Murray.
Well, you know what it is, too? You meet a lot of people who like Bill Murray, and there is a certain – I started to realize, like, if you were at a party and you said, hey, I'm doing a doc about finding Bill Murray, like, literally the people that you want to hang out with would be super into it. Like, it became this like, way to realize if I – like, who's my people? And it's normally Bill Murray people are my people.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, we fall in that category. So you're not just an actress, you're a director as well. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges being behind the camera with, like, budget and just everything that you have to deal with when you aren't in front of the camera?
Sure, totally. You know, I'll actually answer that from a producer's standpoint because I have more experience with that. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing directing the documentary. So I can't give you any advice other than you learn as you go, which I did. But with producing, I've kind of started to really understand it, at least in the, you know, an indie low budget world. I think the hardest part of producing is actually finding the money. And it's always like everyone, when you really get down to it, like, how did you get this financed? It's sort of like its own adventure. It's a mess. A lot of times the people that say they're going to put in money, you know, the people are like, I could write a check right now. $200,000. Hold on. I'll give it to you next week. And they take up all of your time. $200,000, $100,000 is a lot of money to get. It's almost as much money to get as $1 million, or even, you know, more than that, because you're just dealing with a sum of money and something that doesn't really have a guarantee. So I think that's, like, the hardest part for sure. And then, you know, I think what a lot of filmmakers and people who go into it, even as directors, don't realize is the time you shoot on set is that's the fun part. That's the gift. Like, you better fucking enjoy it. You better show up and be like, I've got 3 weeks, because before that is really fucking stressful and really fun, because you're like, okay, it's coming. The movie is great. And then post, you're like, why did I start this in the first place? Like, and it's a really, those are long periods. They're months and months of work, especially in post. So I think you have to fucking love this movie so badly that you can't get sick of it.
I do have a little bit of a follow-up question that it's been on my mind for years. I've wanted to ask someone who's, you know, done directing and producing that just drives me crazy. So why are beds so small in bedrooms? So is it a budget thing? Is it a camera thing? Because I'll give you an example. Jordan Peele's Us. You've got Gabe, Winston Duke, who's a large man, and he's laying on this bed, and it's supposed to be the bed that they share. And logically, there's just no way. So what's the thought process? And why are beds so small in movies?
Well, the room probably isn't that big, and you got to get the cameras around it. That's what I would say. Like, you're not going to bring in a Kel King. Wait next to each other, right? So you can get your two shot, right? You have to get your two shot in. And if they're separated on the bed like this, so I guess so. God, I never thought about that, but it's true.
Oh, it's one of my biggest pet peeves, because you'll have, like, these large people or just average sized people, and they're sharing, like, a twin bed. And it's like, that's not realistic. People don't sleep like that. So it just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of love, speaking of passion, You're a passionate documentarian. You've even got an award named after you. Our fans don't know. It's AMDOC's Sadie Katz Award for Hustle. Talk to us a little bit about that aspect of your career.
Oh my gosh. You know, it's funny. They just gave it. I have to give a shout out to the wonderful director who just won it. Her name is Sarah June Ingram, and she just got the Sadie Katz Hustle Award from Amdocs last weekend for her doc about Bombay Beach, which is so cool. The Salton Sea, it's called Passing Through. You know, it's kind of wild because I didn't get to go to the film festival this year, but I'm like, well, somebody has an award with like my name on it. Actually, I said to my husband, I go, it's a little intimidating. Like, do they look me up on Instagram and they're like, who does this bitch think she is? Or like, or because of the filmmakers that won like last year, this wonderful filmmaker who did this, you know, the Inconvenient, isn't Inconvenient, I don't know. Anyway, these filmmakers like do these huge projects. And I'm like, maybe the award I had to accept this year kind of gets to be its own thing. You know, it's not about me anymore. It's very cool. It's named after me. But it basically, when the Bill Murray Experience was at Amdocs, I was very crazy about filling up the theater and coming every week for kind of months before really promoting the movie. I made sure when we were there, the big deal in the movie was that I was chasing Bill Murray with like 100 balloons. So I had just a ton of balloons. I had big balloon arches. I had the Bill Murray Experience spelled out for like 75 feet in these giant balloons. So like, I kind of took over all of Amdocs. Like everywhere that everyone went, they were like, it almost looked like I sponsored the film festival, which I think is a great, I mean, God, if you really get into a film festival that you really love, it could get really expensive to do this for all of them. But you know, you go to a film festival and they'll have like a toothbrush with like some tie-in. They'll have like a whoopee cushion for this funny movie. And they'll give it out as free giveaways. I think I did like I threw one of the parties, like volunteered for one of the opening night parties. And I just was like a general nuisance. I went to everyone's screenings and, you know, got all the filmmakers to come to mine. I drank buckets of wine with everyone. Nice. I'm going to say that was buckets. afterwards, the following year, Teddy Grua was so cool and he founded, you know, Amdocs. He's the president of it. And he was sort of like, this is what filmmakers should really do. Like, this is why when they show up. So he kind of came out with like, you know, the Sadie Katz Hustle Award for films that are more than audience favorites. They're sort of like, you know, the ones who like hustle everybody and get them excited about the film, which is a lot of, you know what? It's really hard to do because some filmmakers are kind of embarrassed. They're like, I did all this work and now you want me to beg people to come see it. But that's, you know, what's necessary.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in 2016, you co-starred in Blood Feast with Rustler, who we've seen before on our show in A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. How was he to work with? Any fun stories?
Oh, I do have fun stories. Robert Rustler, gosh, he's an interesting guy, right? He's like edgy. He has an edge to him.
Like, he does.
He's not like your classic nice guy. I'm not saying he's not nice, but so we filmed it in Germany. And when I met him, he was with Carolyn Williams and Sophie Monk, and they had already been around for a few days shooting, I think like for a day or two. So I met him and he was like my queen, which was cool. Everyone called me like, you know, goddess Ishtar queen. And I think like I basically ran up and jumped into his arms. It was a really weird relationship. Like, I wonder what it would be now, because in a way he's such a presence, and Ishtar had to be like this thing that got in under his skin. So, you know, and how do you get under someone like Robert Ressler? Like, he has a very strong presence. And so I was kind of fucking with him a lot. And I don't know. I think it took a couple years for him to get that I was fucking with him. I don't know. I just saw him at a Blood Feast signing, and he was really cool. And I think he just had a baby and he's gotten married. He has, you know, he already had, like, I think 3 boys. And I just had my baby, and my baby was there, my husband. And I almost wanted to ask him, like, I wanted to ask him about it, but yeah, it was weird because he was doing a lot of, it was a dark film for him. You know, no matter what, even if actors are doing something that's seen as comedic or, you know, over the top, like, if you're, you know, slicing and dicing bodies, if you're doing any justice to it, which I think he actually does a really great job, you're kind of putting yourself in like a dark, weird ass place. Right. So, you know, Robert was definitely like, I'll give you a good story. We shot in Germany at this BDSM club that was underground. And I'm going to make it even worse. They do golden showers. They do golden shower
night. Oh, shit.
They do. Literally. So when you go in, there's lockers, right? Now, they had cleaned it out and we did it like during the day, and at night it was this fucking thing. So there's lockers for people to put their stuff, right? And I assume it's also like a, you know, it's a homosexual gay experience. Not like chicks are there. I don't think chicks are that into like being shit on, but I mean, some of them, but
I guess.
So we get there and like, it's weird that you could feel like a certain darkness in the club. So you would go back and it was like this long cave with all these like different rooms, but it was like you were in a cave and on the bottom was cement with like literally drains. Right. Ugh. And there was rolls of toilet paper attached to like chains and like these makeshift toilets, but not toilets, just the seats. So like someone could sit up there like 5 feet in the air, and it was gnarly. So when we do that Blood Feast at the end with the table, it's at the very end of this crazy place. There's no light in, there's candles everywhere. It's totally set up. And then we have, I think it was Max is down and we're like literally cutting into him. It's supposed to be Sophie Monk's boyfriend in it. And Robert's like eating it, and Goddess Ishtar's like, basically I was almost pretty much nude besides like a wig and some nylons and my chain, you know, metal.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know if there's a end to that story. It just was like a very fucking weird thing to do, because you're also just filming a movie for hours and hours, but
right,
you're filming it in the weirdest, like, that's a place you never forget the location that you're filming as you're filming.
I'd imagine you probably never forget the smell either.
It didn't smell. That's the whole thing. Okay. Like, there was no smell. I don't know. It didn't even smell like bleach. It just smelled like dampness, like darkness. Like, right. I don't know how they got it that clean. This was, pre-COVID, where everyone was less like insane about stuff. But
right.
I mean, I saw some shit. Like, I didn't see shit. I saw some.
Yeah, I know what you meant. I know what you meant. We saw some things.
It was wild. You know, and also in Germany, like, smoking is super acceptable. And there's like smoking like machines everywhere. Like, you're walking down the street and then all of a sudden there's like an old school, there's like a school and then a cigarette machine. And like, we just had trays of cigarettes. So It was a, like such a funny different, when you film all the country, it's like you have such a different experience with everyone. It's so weird.
Right. But that's good. And, you know, I'm sure like it's that kind of goes into my next question. I mean, you've had 63 plus acting roles under your belt with, I mean, there's 15, I think you have upcoming projects that are listed. I mean, a majority of them have been horror. What is it about the genre that draws you into it? What does it for Sadie Katz horror wise?
Well, I'll tell you, in the beginning, I think what really did it is I was so nervous. So, and this is when I would go into the audition rooms. So, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, a fan of horror. So like, you know, if you were a kid in the 80s and 90s and now, but I would go into the audition room and I'd be so nervous, like shaking, that I had figured out if I could fake the first 2 minutes not being nervous, like if I just gave myself 2 minutes of like being the most confident badass, that the second they would go, okay, we need you to start, my whole body would quiver. And I'm such an emotional being. Like if I get emotional right now, I like tears go, my body, like, you know, I have like a very shaky, and I started auditioning and figuring that out. And people would be like, what the fuck? How'd you do that so quickly? But that was like, you know, they would freak them out. They'd be like, oh my God, do you need time to prepare? I got it. And then, so that's part of it. And then the other thing is once I started playing like evil characters and going really dark, which is great, it's not a lot of girls or not a lot of actresses are able to do that in a real manner, you know, because it's, you have to decide that it's okay to be ugly. And, you know, it's taking a different kind of a risk. You know, so I think it just kind of went that way. Like I'm doing other projects that aren't horror now, but you know, once you go in that way, like people pick it up right away because horror fans are so awesome.
Right.
So then you're like, fuck, okay, I guess I'm a scream queen now. How the fuck? I thought I was going to play nice girl roles, but I mean, what do you do with a voice like this? You go to clubs in Germany. No.
Oh, Jesus.
No.
This has been an amazing interview. All right, back to it. Sorry. I'm a big fan of the Wrong Turn franchise. And unfortunately, Miss Sadie, I have not seen 6, but I'll make that a priority to see 6. I've seen 1 through 5. But Wrong Turn is a franchise, definitely a cult classic among horror fans. Talk about how that role as Sally in Wrong Turn 6 came about and your experiences with it.
You know, this is like my only film that I auditioned for that had this kind of experiences. I had like 2 directors reach out to me that I had worked with. There's so much nudity in Wrong Turn 6, okay? Like there's nudity in all the Wrong Turns. But
I was going to say the whole franchise, yeah. But
Wrong Turns, like... I actually think it's done better than you know, 5 or 4, but you know, whatever, fans all have their own perspective on it. But so that was the thing. Like they were, it was in LA, everyone kind of, people were still auditioning too in the rooms, and everyone was like, oh, there's this big horror franchise. They're taking non-union actors, or they want non-union actors, and it's going to shoot out of the country. They didn't say where, and they didn't say the franchise, but I had 2 different directors say there's this really twisted, cannibalistic, incestuous, you know, girl that you need to play from West Virginia, and it's you.
And what?
She has to have like, you know, there has to be a whole weird dynamic. And 2 random directors that had nothing to do with the project, but heard about it, reached out to me. So I was like, fuck, okay, get me an audition. So I got an audition, and then I got them to write letters of recommendation that I was really cool to work with. And like, you know, it was like something that I, you don't get those kind of opportunities. I knew it was 20th Century Fox. So I got like, I am going to leave fucking nothing to chance. I went out and got my hair real big, like West Virginian. I did hire an acting coach and went with my sides. I went there like, you know, I spent hundreds of dollars going over the sides. So like when I walked in that room, I wanted to be like, I'm fucking here, motherfuckers. If you don't cast me, I will kill you myself.
Nice.
And, you know, but you can't do that unless the part is yours. Do you know what I mean? Like I haven't done this to that extent because I haven't had that same feeling. And maybe I haven't had to for a lot of stuff now because of that. But, I think too, when you get to the audition space and it's kind of a mind fuck because you're in shock of like, there's 20 actresses that look just like you. It's like a room full of blondes that, you know, it's one's not prettier than the other because they're all sort of in the same category. You know, we're all around the same height. We're all, you know, somewhat thin, somewhat curvy, but it's the same girl, more or less, you know? So you have to, it's like, I was so prepared and felt so good about it that when I went in the room, I was like ready to go. And then when I got the call back, you know, they were really nervous. Sometimes when you cast actors to do nudity as well as like be a strong actress, they're going to a different country and maybe they'll back out of it, which one of our actresses tried to back out of it, but not me. And so when you're auditioning, they make you kind of disrobe on set. So I was like really over the top with it. Like, you know, I said, I'm fine. You go behind the curtain. I was doing everything. But the biggest thing is I studied Cat on the Hot Tin Roof and kind of applied it to Sally and that kind of feeling of like she needs to have sex so bad because she's all tangled up emotionally and that's her thing. And I'm really proud of getting booked in that, like no matter what, because I felt like I really deserved it, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I was like, I fucking really showed up for this. I got the opportunity and I seized it. And, you know, so I have all these like really kind of, you know, like a little bit dramatic feelings about it because I felt like it was a marathon that I ran successfully and there wasn't any accidents. There wasn't any freebies. It was like, here I am. And you know what it did. It gave me all these horror parts. It gave me all these, you know, I broke the rules right when I got there. And we were told not to leak anything to the press. I guess I can say this now, but I was like, I'm going to leak it to the press that I've been cast in this. So Dread Central, like kind of like gave a little information to just slightly so I couldn't get in too much trouble. And then immediately when I got home, I told all the cast, like, take your money and hire a publicist. Like this could be something that gives you something, you know,
right.
Like
right.
It's really hard to be a leading actor. So like if horror will take me, then I am arms wide open. So that's what I did. And I worked with Clint at October Coast and, you know, it ended up being kind of the right strategy for me. I'm really grateful for it.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about this, the movie Scorned. You wrote it in 2013, which I saw, now correct me if I'm wrong, I saw that it was loosely based on some real life experiences with that. Can you walk me through that process and, you know, just kind of how, if that's true, and if it is based on real life experiences, how can you use that as creative fuel?
Somehow the Wikipedia says that. And it's like, this girl goes completely crazy, but her name is Sadie. And it's like the most twisted thing. And then, you know, she kills them and gets away with it. So it's so hilarious that that's what our wiki says. But
yeah.
So my writing partner was Mark Jones of the Leprechaun franchise. And also Rumpelstiltskin. And we had written like a sort of serious true crime script together. And then I went through this insane breakup. You have to remember, I was like in my early or my mid 20s. And I just was like an insane lunatic, like, you know, just spinning. I was like jealous and crazy and weird. And we started talking about the idea. And then I chilled out. So, you know, we would go to this cigar group and we started talking about the idea of like how women spin out in a whole other twisted way. Like nothing is scarier than a woman who has like PMS and she's fucking pissed at you. I mean, it's not the same as a man because it comes from something way more primal and they're in your face. Like a woman will fuck with you. Man will just like beat you to death and, you know, do other bad things, but a woman will like, she'll make sure. So, you know, Mark and I started talking about if you let a woman just go, how would it be? And then we kind of, you know, I hadn't gotten my break yet. And so we talked about doing like this showcase piece of, you know, this girl who gets cheated on by her best friend with her boyfriend and she goes off her meds. And we kind of wanted it to be a little bit like Misery. So that was like,
yeah,
not. So we, you know, we wrote it and we just basically, you know, we drink whiskey and chain smoke and those were the good old days. No. And we would recite like the nastiest, most terrible dialogue and people would be at the cigar store and, you know, we'd throw like the worst mean lines at each other. And it was kind of like a wild thing to do. And then when it was done, it was like very, you know, it's very twisted, the whole thing. Like, you know, she pretends that she's going to microwave the dog and, you know, shit like that. She breaks the ankles just like a Misery because that's her favorite movie. And we, you know, long story short, we ended up selling it and to Anchor Bay Anchor Bay decided to give us like $3 million to do it, which was a lot of fucking money. Right. And when that happened, they were like, well, we want a bigger actress. I hadn't done really anything, you know. I'd shot a couple of movies as the lead, but they hadn't come out yet. So it was like a very weird thing because
I bet.
I was getting like Writers Guild. I was getting a shitload of money for this script and it was really exciting. But like the reason I wanted to do it.
Right.
And I had like, I had created this fucking crazy character in my head. Which is what is so funny because you never know, because Wrong Turn ended up such a bigger movie for me. And a lot of like Sally is what we had in Scorned. And, you know, of all the actresses who could have played that character, Anna Lynn McCord is brilliant. It's such a bummer that the movie, you know, didn't do better. I think there's a cheekiness that people didn't really get that was on purpose. You know, that maybe it just like, we wanted it to feel a little like early 90s. And so I don't know if people picked up on like the humor of it, but she really should have got a lot of accolades because she is fucking brilliant in it.
She is great. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's a crazy person. So you gotta be a little crazy to play crazy.
Her character in Nip Tuck was right along those lines too, I believe. Right. So yeah, she was absolutely right in the wheelhouse.
Right. So yeah, I mean, she runs high, you know, and it's like she got the character too really well. I feel a little bad when I see the girl who played Jennifer Viva Bianca because, you know, I think the role was really fun for Anna Lynn, but
right,
you know, Viva was like very much a victim, and she gets her say a little bit, but yeah. And then Billy Zane's in it, but really Anna Lynn is so good in it; it's insane.
So you kind of brushed off the rumors about that being based on real experience. So I got to ask, where are the bodies? I'm just kidding.
Well, my husband always says to me that I'm the scariest woman he's ever met. I'm the only woman who's ever scared him. You know what? It's funny. I have a really hot temper, but it's like a quick fuse because I get really angry and then I burst into tears. So it's like, and it's also a little bit like a ridiculous anger. It's like, you know, I'm going to rip your fucking eyes out. It's like that kind of like, so I think my husband and I have been together long enough and he's kind of a badass himself. So, you know, maybe I would never date like a stereotypical nice guy. Cause I feel like I would just like, my personality would just like crush them. So, you know, I need someone who can like hang in the ring with me. I'm getting soft. The older I get.
Yeah. And kids, that turns you, does it to you.
But I've threatened to bury a lot of people. It's, you know, I can't stay mad long. I like, you know what happens is I forget that I'm that mad at someone. Do you guys do that? Like I'll literally run into someone who fucked me over, but you know, we're at a party, I had a glass of wine and I'm like, you know what? Life's short. It's all right.
Yeah, not me. I'm a grudge holder. I hold grudges too much.
I was going to say, not Brian. But next, I want to ask you about Space Wars. You play Elnora. Yes, we do horror, but we're definitely sci-fi fans as well. This movie seems to be a mixture of a few different genres, including horror. Tell us a little bit about Space Wars.
Dude, it's such a fun movie. It really, like, if you're a fan of Star Wars, the only Star Wars that matter, the OG, and like I want to say there's a little bit of Spaceballs, but it's not that campy, but it is. It's like a kiss to the fans who love B movies, and I think Garo, you know, I had already done Automation with him and his movie was, you know, about a robot that falls in love with the coworker. And it was honestly like one of the sweetest films I've ever done. Like at the end of the movie, I was like crying for the fucking robot and it was the campy. It was supposed to be a B movie. You know, there were lines like, you don't need lasers and shipping and receiving, you know, it was like really kind of silly lines. And when Garo approached me about Elnora, it was like, the script seemed so big. It was like, how the fuck are we going to afford to do this script? And, you know, it's a lot of CGI and stuff. And, you know, I think it's kind of one of my favorite B movies because it's wildly ambitious. Michael Pare and Sarah French are really lovely together. Like there's, you know, we've got our sexy girls too. And there, it's really sort of just so much fun. And like, he basically was like, we wrote you as a female Darth Vader. And I was, and nice. Then I saw my costume, my wardrobe, and I had like the upturned collar and, you know, the slick back hair and it was just so fun to play something like that. And
right.
I really hope that they do a sequel. Cause I feel like the bugs and the things that, you know, needed to kind of get figured out, the sequel could be even better. I feel like if you're a sci-fi fan, you got to watch it and like weigh in on it. And then like, let me blow your mind and be like, dude, we shot this in like 10 days. Like a lot of the set was like repurposed. So if you're like an indie fan and you love B movies, I feel like you'll get it.
Awesome. So you've also mentioned in our talk today that, you know, you mentioned your family, you got a kid and you're married. Can you talk to us a little bit about balancing your acting career and your home life, your family life, and even starting a production company on top of it?
Well, I have two kids. So I have a 22-year-old and I have an 18-month-year-old. My husband's watching right now. Who's taking a nap, which is crazy. So they're 21 years apart.
I'm 20 years older than my brother, so I get that.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's wild, right? You know what? I had my son, the 22-year-old Griffin, who bless him. Like, honestly, I wouldn't even be able to pursue anything except he wanted it for me because he knew how important it was. And like, I was a single mom. I just got divorced. I moved to LA with the goal of being an actress and like pursuing my dreams. I had just left a religion. And in a way, it's crazy because I had all these acting classes where like there was all these like trust fund babies, and like I'm talking like smoking hot chicks who like were very secure in themselves and, you know, who maybe their parents were paying for them to be there. Or, and I outlasted all of these classes, like hardly anyone stayed in it. And I think part of it was I didn't have anywhere to go. And it was like the only thing that made sense to me. And the more I like dug a hole of pursuing acting, the more I felt like if I quit, it would be this really bad message for my son. So I just had this like monkey on my back, literally, of like wanting him to be, I didn't have to be Emma Stone. Like, you know, listen, maybe it ain't that great to be Emma Stone. Like, do you know that there's the difference? Maybe. You're not home with your kid as much. Like,
right.
You know, yes, it would be great to have that kind of money and do those kind of parts, but whether or not I want to, you know, shoot 12 hours a day for a year, I don't know. Like, I really like my life, you know?
Right. Right.
So I think it was, I did a lot before my son started kindergarten. I like did plays and I studied acting and I didn't really get to go for it. And then I was like 30 by the time I got to be like, fuck it, going for it. And everyone was like, well, you're not an actress yet. And you're 30 years old. Like, it's over. It's done. But by then I was able to play all these characters because I really lived a fucking crazy life by then. So like, what did I know about playing sexy at 22? You know,
right.
You may be, you're not really you're a beautiful being or you're a young being, but you're not sexy. You don't know how to take over a room for real. So it kind of gave me this cool advantage of like being a 30-year-old woman who still looked young, who was a little more secure in myself, but also who had navigated LA for 8 years and realized like how to come in and be like, this fucking room's mine. And
nice.
Know how to hold my own in scenes. And that was like such a gift. And, you know, by then I had earned my dues. Like I had paid my 10,000 hours. So,
right.
You know, yes, I would love to make huge amounts of money. I would love to be able to have projects that maybe had bigger budgets, but like all I ever wanted to do is be a working actress. I wanted to be a mom, but I'm saying besides that. So that was really important to me. But a lot of times because of being a mom and a single mom and stuff, I didn't get to do projects back to back. So like whether or not that killed things, probably, you know, I come back and, you know, I come back from Bulgaria and I'm like, I've been gone for 30 days and my seventh graders decided not to turn in homework for a month. So I can't, you know, go to Big Bear and, you know, hang out and kill people in Big Bear. But like that balance gave me something else. I think that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't give up. I'm glad that I got to have that. And, you know, it made me a little bit grounded and realized like being famous isn't the most important thing. Even being, you know, rich, I've been in wealthy situations, doesn't make you happy. And like, ultimately your family and then working with people that are fucking cool is what's really great.
That makes so much sense. Absolutely.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. You know, we're about to wrap things up and I just want to ask, what is next for Sadie Katz? So you have a ton of projects coming up. What can you tell us about them and what are you most excited about? And we would love for you to shout out your social media where the fans can follow you.
Oh, great. Okay. I have a great movie that's like a thriller with Mike Marino. Very good friend of mine. Mike Marino is the director, called Clutch. And I think that that's going to be really gritty and cool. Do you guys know Mike Ferguson? You should interview him because it's fucking fun. Who's in everything.
Okay.
We're about to do a Dracula remake.
Nice.
For the newly formed Bloodbath Films. That's a little bit like, you know, think of like a Troma, but little, you know, we were just talking about, you know, all these films being under this banner of Bloodbath. And I'm really stoked about that. I'm playing Lucy, if you're familiar with the Dracula story. So I'm like,
oh, yeah.
I'm like, fuck yeah. Absolutely. And let's see. I'm actually, if you know Jason Horton, who's really a cool director, he's really a real champion for indie films. I'm going to come in for A Hard Place, which also has Felissa Rose in it, Bei Ling, a lot of other actors. Felissa's a good friend of mine. So anytime we kind of share a movie screen, I'm stoked about. And gosh, I really do. I'm kind of excited because I have some real projects coming up that I'm like, they're spaced out enough. I can still be at home, and I keep my fingers crossed that we do part two of Space Force. And I already told Garo I will kill him if he doesn't have me come on. I will come after him. And oh, you want my Instagram handle? Sadie Katz, SadieKatz.
Go follow her.
Follow
Absolutely.
Me.
I'm excited about that Dracula.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We really appreciate your time, Miss Sadie.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This was fun.
My answers are so long. I watch it later.
That's great.
Jesus Christ.
No, that's no, great. No, it's great. Trust me. Yeah, so good.
We've been on the other
end.
We've had
the opposite.
Yeah, we've had the opposite. Where it's like pulling answers out of people. So this was great.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always stoked. You've had some great guests. So I was like, fuck yeah. I felt glad to be part of your family there.
Absolutely. Well,
thank you. We're very glad to have you.
Just want to remind everybody.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.